attempt to organize this crew of people, very enthusiastic people, whom we meet most Sunday evenings, to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and lots of things that are connected to it, wireless technology in general. There's a lot to learn about ham radio and wireless techniques, how do those antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers, how does all that jazz work, antenna tuners and impedance matching and propagation, and how do each of the bands behave, microwave versus non-microwave. There's 26, 27 different kinds of ham radio. The one you're listening to right now, FM 2-meter ham radio, is just one of the 26 or 27 kinds. Let me drop. And if you're not completely happy with that one, before you give up the whole hobby of ham radio, try one of the other 26. Guarantee you'll find something there that'll please you. If you want to see the variations you can have, visit somebody who does fast scan amateur radio television. I mean, some of these guys put out programming, so to speak, that's pretty high in quality with zoom lenses and split screens and all kinds of things like that. Talk to a guy that does meteor scatter or moon bounce or HF communication, you know, the guys that do DX and try to run up 315 countries. That's just one kind. That's one of the most popular kinds, but it's a very competitive kind. So the TechNet itself attempts to tap into the vast brain power that exists in the tri-state area. There are some real smart people in northern New Jersey, southern New York, and western Long Island, and southeastern Connecticut. We try to tap into that brain power quite often when somebody asks a particular question. Somebody with knowledge in that area will give us the benefit of his experience. Rarely do we have a canned package where there's a clearly defined subject of discussion. The majority of the subjects discussed on the TechNet are the subjects you bring as questions. So for the most part, it's your show, if you know what I mean. For those who sign in the beginning, and during the first hour, we make an attempt to give everyone at least a brief answer during the first hour. In other words, once you've signed in the beginning, rarely are you ever going to have to wait for more than an hour to get an answer. Beyond the first hour, Mel will tell us what emails he has had, emails and snail mails for the guys that are just getting their license. Paul, WS2N, will tell us what NASA is doing in space. After that, all hell breaks loose. There are no holds barred. We discuss anything to do with radio, electronics, physics, whatever is on people's mind. Because from my point of view, inside of a real ham radio operator there is a scientist trying to get out. And so a scientist is a person with curiosity, and he can have curiosity on any subject. And there are many articles telling you that the way mankind really makes progress is for certain individuals to develop curiosity. Even though the subject may at first sound like it's got no connection with reality, no practicality, you can never make a dime with it, and no one's ever going to benefit from it. It's easy to come to those conclusions. Be amazed how many times in the history of science or physics where, and astronomy and so on, somebody had a crazy idea, and it turned out to be very valuable at some later time. So, know ahead of time that very wild subjects are going to be discussed beyond the first hour and a half or so. And there are people who are displeased with that. There are 800 channels on your particular 2-meter radio, and you got a hell of a lot of other ham bands. Know ahead of time that's going to take place. If that displeases you, you don't have to force yourself to listen to this particular channel. There's a lot of other channels to listen to. You will, from time to time, hear people who, for whatever reason, want to be disruptive. That's the name of the game. It takes place in London and New York and in Chicago and San Francisco and Dallas. Although Dallas thinks they found a solution for it, they've got their rather quick ways of justice, and there are very few disruptors in Dallas because people will come and convince them you don't want to do that. So you will hear disruptors from time to time. What it really is, in my opinion, is a person who's unhappy with his life. He hears people enjoying themselves, sharing information on something like the TechNet, and they think they're going to be happier if they can disrupt that. You'll also notice something else that's been going on for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and that is people will listen on the input and find out, are they hearing the disruptor, and by by reporting that, in other words, what signal strength you heard on the input helps pin down where it's coming from. And apparently some of the disruptors think that they've got free rein beyond 11:30 or 12 o'clock at night. They come on with weak carriers at 12 o'clock at night thinking that no one's around listening to their input of their repeater, of their receiver, to find out what the signal strength is. So we've been hearing that quite a bit, weak carriers beyond 11:30 or 12 o'clock at night. So even at that time, if you do hear something on the input, write down what S-meter reading you got and report it to LEN, K2IVX. Just report it to the interference committee at LIMOC.org. Let me drop. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins. You check in by giving us, giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. Yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in saying you're listening because after 29 years, this is TechNet number 1371 of the series that began in September of 1982. By now, we believe there are people listening. It doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. Okay, and no matter how crazy your question is, there is no such thing as a dumb question. The dumb question really means that there's a larger gap between what the person knows and what he would like to know. Therefore, he's most deserving of an answer. We don't have that persnickety attitude that some people have that, that question is below my station, it's below my dignity. So don't be afraid because you've got what you think is an extremely basic question and you think it would be embarrassing to ask. There's no such thing. We're all trying to help each other here. So give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW, TechNet, we're listening.
AC2GY, Russ, with a question, Dick.
KD2PAH, Kevin, with a question.
And let me make sure I got Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Alpha Hotel. Is that correct, Kevin?
Copy that.
Okay, we got Russ and Kevin. Anyone else give me your check-ins, call letters, name, and the word yes?
KD2AYU, Angelo, with a question.
I think that was Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Yankee Uniform. Is that true, Angelo?
Yes, correct.
Okay, we're batting 1,000 here tonight. Next check-in, give me your call letters, name, and the word yes. Go right ahead.
K2AAU, Artie, no.
Okay, we got you, Artie, with a no. One last call. Anyone else with a question? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes at this time. Who is that? Okay. Russ, you're number one on the runway. Go right ahead with your question. AC2, Golf Yankee, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. This is Russ, AC2GY. My question is around antenna tuners, and it was something I was thinking about today. If you have a radio that is transmitting through an antenna tuner to an antenna, what exactly is that antenna doing? Because the more I think about it, the less sense it makes, because that tuner is not going to make that antenna radiate any differently or any better. So I was just wondering, how do antenna tuners improve the radiation of the radiating ability of an antenna? Back to you, Dick, AC2GY.
You've asked a rather good question, Russ, and you're in very good company. If I asked the question correctly on the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon when it's packed with people, I think 80% of the people would have a large number of misconceptions on what an antenna tuner does. An antenna tuner, an impedance matcher, it's got lots of names, properly used is an extremely beneficial item because transmission lines and antennas have got a really crazy characteristic in the way they interface with each other. It's a troubled marriage is the best way I can put it. In the ideal world, your transmission line, which might be 50-ohm coax, if it was feeding an antenna that acted as a 50-ohm resistor, a perfect antenna as far as impedance is concerned, then all of that valuable 100 watts of power that your 8310 meter rig generates goes down that transmission line. All of it hits the antenna, gets absorbed by the antenna, and in theory, all of it gets radiated to space, and you're making contact. That's the ideal world. In the real world, every real antenna is not a pure 50-ohm resistor. As the antenna has any amount of leftover inductive reactants or capacitive reactants, as well as that 50-ohm resistor, or even if the antenna is a pure resistor, but if it's not a 50-ohm resistor, it's a 40-ohm resistor or a 60-ohm resistor, there's a zillion ways that the antenna can be less than ideal on its impedance, and the transmission line reacts in the way that you and I don't like. Let me drop. If the antenna, if the transmission line does not see a pure 50-ohm resistor, which on a Smith chart is the dot in the center of the screen, and if the dot is to the left, it's lower ohms, to the right, it's higher ohms, if it's up, it's some inductive reactants, if it's down from the center, it's a capacitive reactant. So if you're anywhere away from the center of an ideal Smith chart, which represents the impedance of your antenna, the crazy way a transmission line behaves is that not all of the energy that you've generated goes into the antenna. You apply it all to the antenna, but the antenna acts like it's rejecting it. Now, is it the antenna rejecting the power or the transmission line not giving it to the antenna right at the tail end? That's semantics. The bottom line is that if the antenna is anything but 50 ohms, some amount of power gets reflected by the antenna and heads back down toward the transmitter. Your standing wave ratio meter is really measuring reflected power ratio. Your network analyzer is measuring reflected voltage ratio. It's really the same thing. It's just a matter of what units you use. So some amount of power doesn't stay at the antenna. It reflects off the antenna and comes back toward the transmitter. We call it standing wave ratio. If the standing wave ratio is 1-to-1, that means all the power got absorbed, nothing got reflected. And there's ways of converting from standing wave ratio into reflected power ratio, into reflected voltage ratio. There's ways of converting all that. We won't go there right now. Let me drop. So, in my example, if I had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna, take my word for it, 89% of the power gets absorbed by the antenna, 11% of the power gets reflected back if you've got a 2-to-1. If you've got a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio, half the power gets radiated by the antenna, and half of it gets reflected back down the line. A fairly undesirable situation. So you can see what's happening here. The antenna tuner, when it's connected at the transmitter, takes that reflected power and re-reflects it forward. That's what it's really doing. You think it's taking your antenna that maybe is acting like a 30-ohm resistor, and the antenna tuner is reconverting it internally electronically so the transmitter doesn't see 30 ohms, the transmitter sees 50 ohms. And by the way, your transmitter acts better when it sees 50 ohms. So when you've got reflected power, that's a fancy way of saying the transmitter is going to see some other impedance. Even though it's 50 ohm coax cable it's feeding, so the input to the coax cable will act like something else. So the transmitter is not going to behave quite as well. It'll create some distortion, not as much power output, whatever. And of the power that gets to the antenna, a substantial percentage of it gets reflected if you've got standing wave ratio. So you put your antenna tuner between the transmitter and the transmitting cable, the transmission line. It does some magic electronically that makes whatever your antenna is, resistive, reactive, conductive, whatever, it corrects it such that the transmitter sees pure 50 ohms. In the process, you didn't know it, but what it really was doing is taking every bit of that reflected power from the antenna, re-reflecting it forward, not only re-reflecting it forward, re-reflecting it forward exactly in phase with the power your transmitter is generating right now. So the voltage your transmitter is generating right now and the voltage that got reflected from your
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The voltage that your transmitter is generating right now and the voltage that got reflected from your antenna, those two voltages add together and become the new forward power once that antenna tuner is properly adjusted. A real good antenna tuner wastes not one single watt of power. It runs ice cold. It's a perfectly shielded structure. The transmitter no longer sees any reflected power. All the power that's available to you is now delivered to the antenna with one slight catch. And that is, as you use the antenna tuner, The only thing that's not ideal is that if your transmission line has any amount of loss, insertion loss, because the power is reflecting back and forth, some of the power is reflecting back and forth, therefore the power reflecting back and forth, that fraction experiences some extra loss. So with standing wave ratio, you get a little bit of extra feed line loss. And there's curves in the antenna book or in the radio amateur's handbook that'll help you find out how much that is. If this is the most ideal world, the antenna tuner would be right at the antenna, and now you'd have no extra loss of the feed line. But of course, that's very inconvenient. A couple of manufacturers will make a remotely tunable antenna tuner thing where you put it up at the antenna, the other end of the transmission line, and you remotely control it from the shack. But that difference is kind of small. You don't really need to go there. You're better off, rather than buying that very expensive item I just described, you're better off buying a slightly better transmission line that has lower loss, therefore the percentage of loss due to the reflection goes away, or there's a zillion ways you can retune your antenna and you can make the impedance perfect if you want to. And I've got some articles that are on the website of WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. I've got an article there that tells you how to make your dipole. Let me drop. Whether your dipole is your folded dipole or your fan dipole in your backyard on 80 meters, or whether it's a dipole in the middle of your particular Yagi antenna, it's the driven element. It doesn't matter where the dipole is. There's an article there by K2RIW telling you how to make the impedance of that dipole absolutely perfect by a very simple process that's been a secret up till now. If you want to go there, the choices are yours. So the antenna tuner, a valuable tool, does good things. It does nothing bad, even though it doesn't deserve all the flack that it gets. You'd be amazed how many people who think the antenna tuner takes all the reflected power and throws it away. Well, by conservation of energy, you can't do that. It's a shielded box. It's either sending it back to the transmitter. No. It's sending it into space as radiation. No. It's turning it into heat and getting hot. No. Or it's sending it back to the antenna where it gets reused. Yes. So have faith in your antenna tuner, and it's time you get on this particular bandwagon, if you know what I mean, Russ. And you probably got some more questions. The first time you hear all this jazz, it's not super clear. You're going to have to hear it a couple of times. Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Yankee, K2RIW on the TechNet.
No, Dick, one question. Can you repeat the website that you said? And so basically, the antenna tuner is going to re-reflect the reflected power back down the transmission cable to the antenna, but it's in no way, shape, or form going to make that antenna resonate at any different than it was. It's just going to reflect the power back to it. So it's going to prevent the power from getting reflected back into the transceiver. So I assume it would make better use of a poorly resonating antenna by reflecting the power back to it.
Back to you, Dick. AC2GY.
Well done, Russ. I'm very glad you said those extra statements, because that's another thing that I should have covered. 99% of all the antennas we amateurs use are standing wave structures. That really means that the energy you put onto the antenna, you'd like to believe the energy goes from your transmission line, flows down the wire of your dipole once, and jumps into space. You'd like to believe that. Now let's get to the real world. Radiating an energy off your antenna is hard. You've got to kick that energy 10 or 20 times in a row in the tail before it finally leaves the antenna. That signal you put onto your antenna bounces back and forth in the antenna itself 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated to space. That process of making all of the bounces back and forth of the energy on your antenna stay in phase, to stay coherent, you and I call that resonance. So the bottom line of all this is that every antenna you and I use, 99% of them, are standing wave structures. They have to resonate. You resonate first, that gives you the ability to radiate well. If it doesn't resonate, you don't radiate very well. A 50-ohm resistor that's got a leaky shield on it, it radiates, but it's going to be an extremely weak signal by comparison. You want the antenna to radiate all that power, and you've got to resonate it to do it. But now is the catch. What do you have to resonate? You have to resonate the radiating system. What does the radiating system consist of? Believe it or not, it consists of, in the case of a tube transmitter, it consists of the plate, the anode of the tube, combined with the pi network that's in the inductance and capacitance matching structure that's inside the transmitter itself, the transmission line, the antenna tuner, and the antenna. That total system of those five or so components.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That total system of those five or so components I just mentioned, you will resonate that system. I can take a dipole antenna that's extremely wrong in size, definitely non-resonant. And if I got a low enough loss feed line, if I got an antenna tuner with enough matching range to it, if the output tuning and loading controls of my friend old-fashioned Collins transmitter has enough range to it, I can resonate that whole system. Once the whole system is resonated, it will radiate well. So the antenna itself, once you've got a good long-range antenna tuner, a large-range antenna tuner, it will force the antenna plus the transmission line to resonate. Yes, the energy is now bouncing back and forth, not within the antenna itself. It's bouncing back and forth between antenna, feed line, and antenna tuner. Although it's a little bit lossier, it does resonate and it does radiate well. So you can take any old antenna and make it work on your particular frequency. There's a couple of exceptions to that. If I try to use an 80-meter antenna on 40 meters, where the half-wave dipole is now a full wave, and now the input impedance, instead of being 50 ohms or 70 ohms, is 2,000 ohms, because I'm using it on exactly twice the frequency, that's the nastiness of a full-wave antenna, now the impedance match is so bad that to get back the efficiency is going to be kind of difficult. So there's a couple of exceptions. But with the exception of those couple of exceptions, you can force almost anything to resonate and therefore radiate well. That website I mentioned is the website of Dr. Tom Williams. It's Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org. That's his microwave website. You go to the bottom of that first page, and you'll see Yagi or dipole impedance.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
At the bottom of that page, you'll see Yagi or dipole impedance matching by K2RIW. There's an article there with two graphs. Once you read those 1,500 words of that article, and you look at those two graphs, and it's not too complicated, but it's been a well-kept secret up till now. You can force any dipole you have ever used to be a perfect impedance match without using elaborate impedance matching structures. That's the secret that's been kept from you all this time. There's going to be a pop quiz on this next week, Russ. I'm kidding you a little bit. AC2GY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Call again.
Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. You go to that website. At the bottom of that page, you'll find that article. Back to you, Russ.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. This is Russ, AC2GY. It's now, let's see, it's 8:25 right now, and I think this discussion could go on and on and on, but there were, I think, four or five other stations with questions. So you've definitely answered my question, and I don't want to tie up the net for the other stations that are probably eagerly waiting to ask a question. So, Dick, thank you. This is AC2GY. I'll be listening.
E2HWW with a question on this subject, Dick.
That guy, Russ, is a real smart guy, and that he realizes other people, and he's being magnanimous. Well done. So we're going to move on to the other people and then come back. So, Howie, and Russ, too. We're allowed to come back to this subject after the first hour and discuss it as many times as you want, or you're allowed to bring it up again next week. This whole subject of resonating the antenna, making it radiate well, using an antenna tuner with low-loss feed line, that whole subject is highly misunderstood in the amateur world, and yet that's the main thing we all want to do. We don't just listen. We want to actually talk. We got to talk efficiently. So let's go on to the next person. That's to Kevin, KD2, Baker Alpha Hotel. So right ahead, Kevin, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick.
I have a little bit of an off question. I usually catch a lot of flack when I ask certain questions about it, so I'm going to ask it anyway. Before stepping into amateur radio, I was a very big 11-meter CD person. I still am a bit of an 11-meter talker, but as I'm getting more and more into amateur radio, I'm slowly stepping more and more away from that. Now, my question is, I'm getting ready to set up a mobile 2-meter 440 setup. But the question I have, and the concern I'm concerned with, is I currently have two antennas on the roof of my van. Most of the guys out here are already familiar with my van from the HamFest. I'm the black van with the FCC unit license plate, so most of the guys out here probably know who I am already. I have two 11-meter antennas on the roof of my van, one towards the front of the vehicle, one towards the rear. The one on the rear is grounded as a reflector. The one on the front is a hot antenna as my feed antenna. What I'm looking to do is stick a 2-meter, 70-centimeter antenna directly in between them, mounted through the roof, so that I can also operate my amateur radio equipment in my van as well. My concern is, do you think I'm going to run into issues with my 11-meter stuff interfering because of the power limits that I'm running?
And the short answer to that one, Kevin, is no. No problem. First of all, you don't have to feel bashful about the fact that you first cut your teeth, electronically speaking, as far as wireless is concerned. You started off in the Citizen's van at 27 megacycles. It's an awful nice, very high-quality ham radio operators that first got introduced to electronics was Citizens Band. So there's nothing to be embarrassed about that. It's a possible beginning, and for some people it's a very good beginning. Now, the 11-meter antennas you've got in front and back as sort of a phased array. One of them you said is a reflector, and one is driven, and it gives you a pattern that favors the forward direction if you've done it just right. And you could, if you want to, by the way, electronically switch. You could decide to ground the forward one and feed the rear one, and therefore aim the signal electronically to the rear instead of the front of the vehicle. You could have some real fun with that. Or feed them both in phase, and now it radiates the strongest signal broadside to the left and to the right of the vehicle. So you've got the beginning of a phased array there on 27 megs if you build a switching network into it to feed them correctly at the right time. Let me drop. Now, good common sense would lead you to believe if I put a 2-meter antenna and a 440 antenna in the middle of the roof, let's say somewhat midway between those two 27 megacycle quarter wave ground plane antennas, that the 27 meg antennas are going to be a great big blockage and they're going to disturb the pattern and all kinds of nasty things are going to happen. Absolutely not. When I radiate a signal on 144 megs or with very careful laboratory instrumentation, you could see an extremely minor shift in the pattern. The actual amount of what's called radar cross-section, the amount of reflected signal from those 27 meg antennas, which do not, for the most part, resonate on 144 or do not resonate on 440, they're almost pure pieces of tissue paper, thoroughly transparent. And even if you hit the third or fifth harmonic resonance on one of those, the effect would be fairly minor. Don't worry. About the only other thing you've got to worry about is that if you wanted to run both bands simultaneously, let me drop. If you're radiating 100 watts on 2 meters or 100 watts on 440, at the exact same time, you want to listen on 27 megs to find out what's going on with the traffic. There is a chance that the amount of energy coupled from one antenna to the other will overload the receiver front end on 27 megs or vice versa and give you some spurious responses. Every receiver has got a certain amount of receiver dynamic range, blocking dynamic range, depending on how strong the signal is, the extraneous signal. And even if you ran into that problem with the right kind of filtering, so that the filtering only allows 27 meg signals to flow down that particular piece of cable, 144 meg signal to flow down that particular cable that goes to that antenna, and so on, with the right kind of filtering, all of those antennas could be mounted a couple of inches apart from each other and all run simultaneously. If you had a whole bunch of antennas all connected to the same bumper of the same automobile, they're all operating on different frequencies simultaneously, and if you're smart enough with the right kind of filtering, all of that can be thoroughly compatible. So There's basically good news here, as I see it, Kevin. I didn't say it's super easy, but running some experiments, you'll confirm this, and it's not going to explode. With rare exception, is the energy out of your 2-meter antenna going to damage any of the other pieces of equipment. So you don't have to worry about that. You just may have some disruption when you transmit on one and receive on the other, and by filtering, you can solve that problem. KD2, Baker Alpha Hotel, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Kevin.
See, that's my biggest concern. You edge right on like my biggest concern. You answered most of my questions. But my only concern is I'm not worried about the power output on the 2-meter, 70-centimeter interfering with my 11-meter stuff because, honestly, like you said, I wouldn't be doing both at the same time anyway. My concern is if I'm on my 11-meter gear and I'm just going to throw a number out there, I'm running 3 or 4 kW bird. I'm worried about that output power damaging my amateur radio equipment.
Yep, I hear you, Kev. And as high a power as that sounds, because 27 megs is so unrelated to 144 and to 440, the amount of energy that will get into those antennas is relatively small. However, you have the resources to measure it. When in doubt, don't speculate. Make a measurement. Radiate, let me pick a number, 1 watt or 5 watts on 27 megs. Connect the right kind of instrumentation, another receiver, a spectrum analyzer, a network analyzer. Connect some kind of instrumentation to the 2-meter antenna cable or to the 440 antenna cable while you're transmitting some small amount of signal on 27 megs and measure the insertion loss. And if you measure 40 decibels of insertion loss, which is a 10,000 to 1 ratio, for instance, you'll know that whatever power you radiate on 27 megs, 1/10,000th of it is going to appear on the 144 meg antenna. If that amount of power on the 144 meg antenna displeases you, by putting a band pass filter that only passes 144 and has a whole lot of rejection on 27 megs, you can knock it down by another 1,000,000 to 1 ratio if you want to. So you can measure it in your particular vehicle and find out what the percentage is. By the way, when you make the measurement at 1 watt and you measure 40 decibels of insertion loss, that's the exact same ratio of insertion loss you're going to make if you radiate a kilowatt. The numbers work thoroughly linear, if you know what I mean. So you can, with the right kind of instrumentation, you can make the measurement at a low power that you know is never going to damage anything, find out what the coupling number is in decibels, and therefore you know exactly what you need, where you stand, and you can calculate or measure whether or not your other piece of equipment can tolerate that, or conversely,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Or conversely, if it's more than you think that rate can tolerate, then you can either rearrange things physically to change the amount of coupling, or you can put in better filtering to make sure that the wrong signal frequency doesn't get through to that particular piece of equipment. You've got a lot of possibilities here, Kevin. KD2BAH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, so I had to do a little bit of research and trial and error and find out. And in the future, I'll check back with this and I'll let you know how I made out with my project on that. But Dick, thank you very much. I want to do the same thing. I'm going to pass it on to the next one. And I'm going to want a lot of stuff to try and a lot of stuff to think about.
Kevin, on that last transmission, I'm hearing a lot of echo in your room. I heard everything you said. No problem. Your audio was very low, like you're either talking into the wrong microphone or you're talking into the back end of that particular microphone. Your audio was very low on that transmission. Thought you'd like to know about that. And by the way, as you make these measurements and as you make these changes and whatever, come back periodically and let us know, because you think your situation is unique. Guarantee it's not. There's other people out there. There are other people out there listening to us who are contemplating something similar. Maybe the guy wants to run a kilowatt on 2 meters while he's listening on 1296. And he thinks the harmonic relationship between those two is going to make things real bad. And there's ways of fixing it, even if it does come out not so well at first. The next person who signed in was Angelo. Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Yankee Uniform, if I got it right, Angelo. You're right ahead. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. I'm KD2AYU Angelo. I'm pretty new into a ham, only 2 weeks into it. My question is, I've built plenty of dipole antennas for the 11-meter band, ground planes. I know how they work. And now I'm thinking about building a J-pole, and I'm looking into that. And your ground plane is part of the shield, and your center conductor will be like the radial element. So how does it work on a J-pole when you got your ground and your center conductor going to the same place? Like, wouldn't that you're doing like the RF power on the radio, let's say 10 watts or something, wouldn't that burn out your radio?
Yeah, you've used good common sense. You made a good guess there, Angelo. The answer is no. A J-pole is a ground plane-like antenna, which has this extra resonator at the bottom. And the radio wave knows the difference between what it thinks is the ground and what it thinks is the antenna. You and I, looking at that, say that's one single piece of copper. How can it simultaneously be the ground and the antenna? Yeah, take my word for it, it can. The earth is smart enough to know who's who. The bottom line of all this is that when you build the J-pole correctly, just as well as the dipole, the ground plane, when you build the antenna correctly and properly impedance match it, and you get from your transmitter, and the reason you do putting a small amount of power is you don't want to burn out the fine end of the final stage of your transmitter if the antenna happens to be highly mistuned. But by way of a standing wave ratio bridge, by way of a Bird watt meter, by all kinds of ways, you can find out how much power is going forward, how much power is coming back from that antenna as you tune it. And when you tune the antenna so that all the power is going forward, none of the power is coming back, your forward reading on your Bird watt meter says 10 watts going forward, the reverse reading tells you 0 watts is coming back, that's a fancy way of saying you've just forced that antenna to be a 50-ohm load on that 50-ohm transmission line. You've made the antenna tune correctly. That's your first requirement, resonating antenna, making it tune correctly. Once the antenna is tuned correctly, the transmitter is going to be happy. The transmitter will not be able to tell the difference between your antenna and a 50-ohm dummy load. In either case, all the power goes forward, and the transmitter doesn't see any reverse power, and it's happy. On top of that, almost all modern transmitters, Angelo, have a built-in protect circuit in the final stage, where if the amount of reflected power is too high because the antenna is too poorly tuned or too much of an impedance mismatch, the final stage will either turn itself off or the transmitter will cut itself back and drive power output. Almost all the modern-day transmitters have a built-in protect circuit. You've got to try real hard to burn out that final stage because you've got a poor antenna. The way the average guy gets himself in trouble is he thinks the antenna is connected, but the thunderstorm that happened last night told him to disconnect all of his antennas from the transmitter. And today he's going on the air and he forgot to reconnect those cables. So now the back end of the transmitter is a pure open circuit. That's about the worst case condition I can think of. Most rigs will even protect from that. But if you sneak up on it slowly, you know, you don't transmit full power each time you turn on the rig. The very first time you turn it on, you turn it on to a slow, you crawl up on it, so to speak. You set it for a small amount of power output and make sure that the controls in the transmitter are giving the right kind of indications. Then, again, you would be doing super protection of your final stage of your transmitter. So the bottom line of all this is that a J-pole antenna, properly built, follow somebody's good design, and do all the procedure of tuning it correctly. It's a beautiful thing, and the fact that it looks to you like the ground and the antenna are mixed together and would fight each other, they don't. Start up with a good design. It works like a charm. Take my word for it, Angelo. And by the way, after you build this, come back and let us know about that. KD2 Alpha Yankee Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, thanks, Dick, for answering that question. Like I said, just like you said, it's looking at it by the eye doesn't look good, doesn't look right, but
it does work, and I just couldn't figure that out, how it will work. Like I said, I didn't do research on it, but I'm thinking about building one.
By the way, Angelo, your audio is good this time. Well, no, it was Kevin. Sorry about that. Figuring out how these antennas work, figuring out how a folded dipole works, how a 5/8 wave ground plane works, how a J-pole works, at first, it's not common sense. So I take a little more reading. The nice thing about the Internet is that if you Google the word J-pole antenna, you're going to find a zillion articles on the subject. Some of those articles show you how to build it out of pieces of transmission line. Some of them are going to show you how to build it out of pieces of copper tubing. Some are going to show you how to build it out of coat hanger wire. Some of them are going to explain to you how it works and where the resonating is taking place and where's the highest voltage and where's the highest current on that antenna. So you Google the word J-pole antenna, you're going to find a whole lot of data. You start going through that, and it's going to start making more sense. Get on the air with your J-pole antenna and talk to people about it, and you're going to find people who have gone through the exact same process you've gone through. Didn't understand it at first, didn't seem to make sense. They sort of figured it out, and then they can convey that knowledge to you. So hang in there. All new subjects are a little bit uncomfortable at first. That's the nature of learning. You go to any good school. Let me drop. Any good school on electrical engineering, for instance, they will tell you that the process of learning brand new material that you've never heard of before is going to make you feel uncomfortable. So while you're taking this course, if you feel uncomfortable, that could be a good sign. You're in the process of learning. If you knew exactly what the professor is going to say and you've heard that material a whole lot of times before, yeah, you're going to feel comfortable, but maybe you're not learning anything. You already knew it, if you know what I mean. So that's the natural state of where we are. And we amateurs are trying to teach each other how all this magic stuff works. The schools do only a mediocre job of teaching wireless engineering, particularly when it comes to teaching antenna technology. Very few schools, you can count them on one hand, in the United States, do a medium good job of teaching antenna art and science, antenna design. As it is right now, if a company needs an antenna engineer, the quickest way you can get one is to find a real good ham radio operator. That's a guy who has been fiddling with antennas in his backyard for 5-10 years. He's been talking to people about it. He's got a lot of experience as to what works and doesn't work. He is an antenna engineer. He's got a lot more knowledge than he knows he knows, if you know what I mean. Whereas the schools don't teach it, lots of people will come to me from time to time and say, "Hey, Dick, you seem to know quite a bit about antennas. What book should I pick up that's going to give me all this information?" There is no one book. Probably book number one is the ARRL antenna book. It's really written in English as opposed to highfalutin language with 40,000 terms to the equation. The next book is probably the Radio Amateur's Handbook. You'll be amazed how many well-paid antenna consultants, where you visit their place of work, and on their bookshelf, mounted backwards so you can't see the title, is the ARRL antenna book. They're unwilling to admit to the world that a lot of the information they know about antennas came from a ham radio-oriented textbook. They're also going to have, alongside of that, the $150 book by Vlasic called the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and a few other books there, but the book that they use quite frequently is the ham radio books, and they're not always willing to admit it. I think we've gone through everybody who signed in at first with questions. Let me double check that. If the answer is no, we're going to go back to Howie with this question. So, have I answered everybody who checked in? K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2RS, have comments?
Go right ahead, Alan.
I just wanted to comment on what you were saying about the ARRL books, the antenna book and some of the other books they have, especially for Angelo when I was speaking with him yesterday. And he's really, really just beginning. I have found these books not to be good primers. They're good references, but not good to start. I find that they throw terminology at you without having to find it. They will show graphs and plots that are not telling the whole story. They're missing a lot of information, sometimes even units. So I wouldn't recommend ARRL books as primers. I have a hard time getting through them and have to go to other sources to get some of the basic information. And I even have written notes in the margins of one of the ARRL antenna books to say, how come this is missing? How can you move to this concept when you haven't explained that concept? So you might find that might be confusing. For someone like you, Dick, or the real seasoned ham, it's going to be more of a reminder or a reference book. But for a primer, I don't think they're a really good place to start. That's just my opinion. Over to you, Dick. KC2, RFM.
Alan, you've been from the bottom up through ham radio. What, in your opinion, is a better starting book than those? Which of the books helped you the most, Alan? Go ahead.
If that wasn't really the book, it was experimenting, doing the best I can from putting together either tips or just projects I could find in different books, which I couldn't tell you offhand. I have so many of them. Or right now, the best way to prime yourself is the internet. If I want to learn a subject like this J-Pole, and I was talking with Angela yesterday that even though I've been exposed to them, I've never really studied them, and I didn't understand the intuitive problem that he had found, you know, having the conductors go to the same, semiconductor and ground going to the same element. So what I'll do is I'll sit down at my computer, and I'll just pull up 5 random articles about it, and I'll just read through them. By the time I get to the third one, I begin to get a picture, and that I find to be a better primer. And if it's not written well and the terminology isn't good, I pull up another 5. And before an hour has passed, I've already built a pretty decent picture and have a pretty good primer. And if I'm interested, I'll move on from there. But I can't say there's any one book. It's certainly not the ARRL books, and I've bought tons of them. And I find that they're really not that helpful. Not for me, anyway.
WB2HWW, would you like to make a comment on this?
Yeah, very fine, Howie. Alan, valuable information you gave us. So from your point of view, everyone has touted the ARRL handbooks, but the people touting them are people who already know a lot more than they know they know. I know what you're saying. Alan, give me a rough approximation. What percentage of your knowledge about antennas, for instance, came from the internet? What percentage came from your own experimenting in your backyard? What percentage came from talking to people about it on the air, getting firsthand a description by somebody? I know that these approximations are going to be very rough approximations. That's okay. So what percentage internet, on the air, experimentation, and books? KC2RFN, K2RIW.
Very roughly, I would say 40% comes from talking with people like you or Andy CDL or some of the other older hams I know from the past. That's a good chunk. The remaining 60, maybe 30% is by actually working with the antennas, whether it's commercial antennas I've bought, put together and tested and played around with. By the way, I find that making mistakes and tracking down the mistakes, which I seem to make all the time when I'm assembling antennas or assembling anything, become my best learning tool. You know, they're frustrating and they waste some time, but in the end it's not a time waste. I really learn from the mistakes. And then the balance comes from the internet and maybe some books. If I find an old book in the library, I might read through it or have something lying on my shelves. That's probably the bulk of it that takes it to RFM.
And notice, you guys, what Alan just gave us. He's adaptable. He's eclectic. He's not depending on any one source. He's hanging in there. He's developed enough curiosity. He's developed enough interest in the subject. He knows he's going to be using the antennas for the rest of his ham radio career. He wants to understand them. So he hangs in there and tries all the possible sources. Doesn't expect an immediate answer from any one source right away. Nothing is perfect. So you put forth the effort. You're going to find out about anything you want to know, as long as you've really got the curiosity, as long as you got the perspicacity. I think you know what I'm saying. Hang in there, you guys. Howie, I know you've got a question on this subject, and you've got a question on another subject, and you fire away. WB2HWW, K2RIW in the tech net.
First comment, Dick, is comment on this last thing about how you learn about antennas. Well, Dick, I got into ham radio, or actually CB, when I was about 9 years old. Had a pair of walkie-talkies. Got my first CB rig when I was 10. Got licensed when I was 13 with the novice. Upgraded, just before I got to my 15, maybe a year and a half after that. And where I learned, Dick, was experimenting with antennas. I lived in an apartment, had an SWR meter, tried all kinds of, things to do to figure out how to make them work. And reading articles, but mainly listening. I had a listening. I had a helicopter computer, and I used to listen to the guys on board that they needed. It scored no time in fact. And that's how I went. And by the time I went to the school college,
Howie, you're giving us plenty of RF, nice clean signal, and your audio for the first half of that communication was beautiful. The second half, your audio slowly went down 30 decibels, maybe 40 decibels. I'm wearing earphones and I could hear everything you're saying, and you're describing your experience and how you learned, but your audio at the end dropped down to a very low number, and maybe you want to know about that. But there's a good point. Don't be afraid of making mistakes. With rare exception, almost anything you build as an antenna is a thoroughly passive item. It consists of copper and transmission line and things like that. And there's no, for the most part, antennas don't contain an amplifier, a mixer, and so on. As such, they're fairly impervious to, abuse. So, there's a zillion ways of making a bad antenna. And by experimenting, you'll find out which ones. You'll rapidly find out which ones work and which ones don't work. But nothing bad will happen when you build a bad antenna. When you build a bad antenna, nothing bad will happen. It doesn't explode. Most of our rigs are very good at protecting the final stage, so the rig doesn't get damaged. And even if the final stage of your transmitter did get damaged because you're firing it into an antenna that acts as a dead short circuit, even if that did occur, that's not a showstopper because you've got somebody like Andy, WA2CTL, who can fix anything. And replacing the final stage of your transmitter is a fairly simple process. Well, maybe it'll cost you $10, but it's not the end of the world, so don't worry about that. Let me turn it back to Howie and see how things are going with him. WB2HWW, I wonder if your audio has come back. Howie, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Operator, I had my finger over the mic hole, depending on the way you hold these radios. Yeah, Dick. Okay. Hey, you know what? You got to experiment. When I was playing with radios throughout my junior years, senior high school, I built so many antennas. I lived in an apartment. I made different antennas. I tried loading up into the windowsill, tried loading up into the fire escape. I tried Mac boxes, built Mac boxes, did every kind of crazy thing to get on the air, and that's how you learn. I would call it the school of hard knocks, Dick. The next question is this. It's actually on our previous subject. I want to know what you think of hamsticks. Let's say 10-meter hamsticks. It's slightly loaded. What do you think the difference between that and an exact half wave? I know mathematically they should be there should be no difference in efficiency. I'm thinking of making some antennas out of hamsticks and brackets, either dipoles or inverted Vs. And I just wanted to know experience.
taking the ham sticks and using them as dipoles. We're not talking about 20 and 40 meter loaded antennas. I know they'll be about 95% efficient, but I wanted to know what you thought of the difference between the ham stick, where the first couple of feet is a coil, first 3 or 4 feet is a loaded coil, or helically round, and then the last foot or two is a whip, you know, just a stainless steel whip. And they're about 7 feet. They're a little less than a quarter wavelength compared to using a full-size halfway dipole. I wonder what you thought the differences would be as far as performance is concerned. Even though I know theoretically that there should be no difference, just wondering if anyone's had experience using either the various ham sticks out there, Dick, in dipole configuration where they took two of them and they fed them to a coax.
I've got quite a few opinions on this subject, Andy. Howie, not necessarily based on real measurements. In some cases, it's based on people that I've talked to who have done the real measurements, the real experiment. The nicest kind of an antenna, if you're not using an antenna tuner and you want the antenna to be a good impedance match, is a true half-wave dipole. It's a very nice antenna. It's got literally, physically, darn close to 95% of a half wavelength of real length to it. And what radiates that signal into space is how much current is flowing on that particular piece of wire and how many inches of that wire have that amount of current flowing in it. You can take any dipole-like structure, zigzag it any old way you want, wind it up in a coil and whatever, and readjust the length accordingly, and re-resonate it with a much smaller physical size. The total length from tip to tip, you can make it smaller and smaller by winding helical, by zigzagging it up and down, left and right, all kinds of ways you can bend it. You can physically make it shorter. And you can make it nearly 100% efficient when you do that at the center frequency. But there's the clue. There's the cue. As the antenna becomes physically shorter, in other words, the amount of real estate you've used for the antenna really determines how well it radiates as far as how much energy is radiated on the first pass of the energy down the antenna. You start making the antenna physically shorter. That means on the first pass of the energy down the antenna, and it gets to the open end and bounces back, less of it gets radiated when you've used less real estate. Therefore, it's going to take a greater number of bounces for that same amount of energy to be radiated. It will eventually be radiated, but now, because it takes a higher number of bounces, that really means higher Q, because
repeater, timeout, cancel.
With a higher number of bounces, you're now expecting a larger number of bounces to stay co-phase with each other. That's only going to happen over a shorter and shorter wavelength. So whenever you shrink an antenna physically, by whatever means you do it, there's going to be more bounces. Whatever insertion loss is, because there's resistance in your material, the insertion loss is going to go up a little bit, and the bandwidth will go down. No matter how small you make the antenna, you can make it 100% efficient radiator, but it's going to become more and more narrowband. That's the Bode Fano? No, that's the Chu Wheeler criteria. Mr. Chu and Mr. Wheeler wrote a series of articles, roughly 1948, as to how small can you make an antenna. They wrote articles on what they called electrically small antennas and what are the characteristics. The gain changes very slowly, just a little bit. The efficiency changes very slowly, just a little bit. But the bandwidth changes real fast. It becomes much more narrowband. So you use the right materials, zigzag it any way you want to make it more compact, and at your favorite frequency, it's going to work like a charm, but you're going to need a lot more antenna tuning action if you want to tune away from that frequency when you physically make it small. That's the trade-off, bandwidth versus amount of real estate. And so, in theory, you could make an 80-meter dipole. It should be 132 feet long. In theory, you could make it 30 feet long and behave very well. But it's only going to be 5 kilohertz wide on the 80-meter band, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Howie, KQRIW and TechNet. Your audio sounded very good that time.
Very well aware of that. No, the reason why I'm asking is this. You can look at, you look up these things. Anybody can look this up. MFJ makes robotics. They make something called an item number 1974. It is a collapsible whip. If you can look it up.